This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And Leif Enger, I have been looking forward to having this conversation with you. Obviously, I read Peace Like a River with a million other people when it first came out. And then, of course, there was So Brave, Young and Handsome, and of course, Virgil Wander. And now here we are with I Cheerfully Refuse. And I love this title. And I love Rainey. And I love all of the things that happened to Rainey. And it's a ghost story. It's an adventure story. It's a love story. It's a little different. We're going to talk about language and place and character and all of these things. But Leif, thank you so much for making the time for coming on the show.
Miwa, it's a total pleasure. And let me say, I really enjoy your show. I've listened to so many of them over the past couple of years. It's really been fun.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So Lake Superior is actually where I want to start, though.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've been reading you long enough to know that place is always the thing. Character too, but I want to start with the place because Lake Superior, Rainey, our guy, spends a lot of time in a sailboat on Lake Superior.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for people who live in the upper Midwest, obviously they know what Lake Superior is about. I lived on Lake Michigan for a couple of years, and I have to say it was the first time I'd lived on one of the Great Lakes. Yeah. I'd grown up on the Atlantic, and that is not the same thing. Oh, I was fully unprepared for sort of the depth and the breadth of a Great Lake. So can we start with Lake Superior? Because that is part of the big beating heart of this book.
Oh my goodness. It totally is the beating heart of the book. I mean, it's one of the world's great waters. Something like 10% of the Earth's fresh water on the surface of the Earth, not including aquifers, obviously, is in Lake Superior. It's that big. It's huge. It's 330 miles across. Mm-hmm. It's a long haul. Obviously, it's not the Atlantic. It's not an ocean. It's not salt. It's fresh. It's a big enough water that it creates its own weather. It creates its own mythology. Robin and I moved here to Duluth about 5 years ago, just before my last book came out. And we moved into this tall old house, which is near the university and about six blocks up off the water. And I remember the night we moved in, and we've been going through Duluth often. It was sort of our town. We lived 90 miles away before this. And so we would come here to, you know, go to movies and go to the bookstore and, you know, eat in restaurants down by the water. So we loved it. But the night we moved in, and this still happens, by the way, during the shipping season, which is most of it. The night we moved in, a ship came in from somewhere else on the planet at about 3 a.m. And when the ships come in, they blow their horns in order to contact the bridge. And the bridge then, this century-old bridge, has to, get the gears in motion and lift itself 100 feet in the air so that the ship can move through the canal and get into the harbor. And so the voices of these ships, you know, the ships are maybe 1,000 feet long if they're Laker ships, they're carrying ore. And the ship blows its horn, and it's kind of like that noise that you hear in a Godzilla movie. You know, when the camera kind of shakes, this thing opens its lungs and blasts us right out of bed. I mean, just totally out of sleep, 3 a.m, and we start laughing because, you know, for 30 years, Robin and I wanted to live in a harbor town. And there's no greater proof of being in a harbor town than a ship's horn at 3 a.m. Welcome to Duluth. So it does seem like a place where kind of anything is possible. It's just a different world. The lake has this kind of misty personality, kind of an intense presence. Whatever the lake is doing, that's the mood Duluth is in that day. If the lake is wild and the waves are confused and they're rolling in and you've got these guys out there on their surfboards in November because that's when the gales hit, and they're on their surfboards and they got ice in their beards and they look like spirits walking around on the waves, really anything seems like it can happen. Last summer, here's an example.
Okay.
I'm down at Park Point, which is, you know, one of the longest freshwater beaches in the world. It goes on for, you know, 7 or 8 miles. It's a great place to go down and fly kites, which I do as often as I can. And I'm down there with a friend of mine who's this poet who drives up a couple times a year from St. Paul, and we fly kites together. And this day, man, it was summertime, but the fog was just absolutely piling up off the water and swallowing everything in sight. And we were flying these kites, and there was just enough wind to get the kites in the air, but then, of course, you couldn't see them because they vanish about 30 feet up. So we're just standing there holding these strings that are going into the sky. And all of a sudden, through the fog, we hear the sound of like running and laughing and jostling and shoving. And this football team runs out of the fog. Okay, they're doing a summer workout, and they're cruising down the beach in their shorts. Most of them didn't even see us. They didn't even know we were there. Just two old farts in their jackets holding these strings. And the last guy, the guy bringing up the rear, probably looking for a reason not to work too hard, stops and says hello. And he's like, he looks at the strings in our hands. We're holding these big, like, fishing reels.
Mm-hmm.
String, and then these two white strings just going up into nothing. And he looks, kind of squints up into the cloud, and he says, what are you guys doing? And my poet friend says, well, we're fishing. And the kid looks up, and he looks at us, and he says, well, that's cool. And then he goes running down the beach. Just a fantastic Lake Superior moment. I don't know where else that happens.
No, I honestly can't think of another place. But then again, I'm more of a city person. And part of what I love about I Cheerfully Refuse is you've given us a landscape that's familiar enough in some way, mostly because the people are the people. We may as well be on Mars in a way. I mean, this is sort of the freest you've been to create a world. And obviously, there are bits of mythology in all of the previous books, and they're, you know, miracles, however you want to describe it. You've written a novel that nods to the dystopian, which was not a thing I ever associated with you. And this is still very much a Leifanger novel. This is not, this is, you've not written The Hunger Games. Let's be clear, this is not. But the language and the character, it's like we're one step removed from Virgil Wander. Here we are in that community. Where things are going a little off the rails, because how is anyone making any money, and how do you live in a place like that that's gorgeous, but what do you do for work, right? And now we're kind of in this, well, you never tell us what year it is. You sort of let us just kind of say, okay, we're here, and there are hints that the world has changed. But the language, you create an entirely new language. And it feels a little Shakespearean. It feels a little Herman Melville. There's a lot sort of...
Well, I'll take Shakespeare and Melville. I mean...
Okay.
You know, you talk about the not expecting a dystopia.
Mm-hmm.
And I never expected to write a dystopia.
Right.
But then this phrase kind of came into being in early 2017 called alternative facts. At that point, I started making notes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that seemed like a statement of intent to devalue the truth we all see outside our windows, and to devalue what we all know and what we, you know, and then to stick by that until that becomes reality. And then I felt like, well, someone's trying to make a dystopia in front of my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, how about if I write a novel that just takes place some decades out? I don't know exactly how many. I was thinking in my mind 30 or 40 years, but it could be longer, it could be shorter. Years ago, I remember reading this great set of stories by George Saunders called Civil War Land and Bad Decline. And
that first story, that titular story where you're just like, oh, okay, I'm here, I'm in.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of those books I have to go back to and read every 18 months or so, because it seems so prescient, and it's also drop-dead funny. You know, it's just one of the funnier books I've ever read. And yet it's incredibly sobering, and it's filled with, you know, cruelty interspersed with these acts of just breathtaking empathy. And I read that and I thought, oh, he never really explains how the world came to be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. He doesn't explain it. And the reason he doesn't have to is because elements of that are already in process.
Mm-hmm.
Things are already happening outside of our windows. All you have to do is be willing to look at what could be and then write about it as though it had happened.
Right.
And I loved that. That seemed really revolutionary to me. I don't know if it was. I'm not widely enough read to know that for sure, but it seemed like something different, and I loved it, and I wanted to do something that would, you know, this book is nothing like Civil War Land, but I did take some things that I learned from reading that book and try to employ them here. Yeah.
Like what?
Oh, well, just that whole thing about not having to explain.
Yeah.
It's kind of delightful to work with stuff that, look, can anybody really not imagine what it would be like if 16 families owned everything? We can all imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
Headed
mm-hmm.
that way fast. That's an easy thing. And then what would happen if that were the case? Well, your infrastructure would start to fall off the map, and your communications would start to fall off the map. The internet would get really, really wide and really, really shallow until it just wasn't worth having anymore. You know, Rainey at one point says, well, Lark and I, we were early abandoners. And he's talking about digital technology. And there's not a day that goes by that I'm not tempted by that idea. I mean, how can you not be tempted?
I want to go back to Rainey for a second because I love this guy and I love his voice.
Thank you.
And he's a very sort of gentle soul.
Yeah.
And he's very much of your sort of orbit. He does ground me in your sort of angerness. he really does. No, he does. And I really, yeah, the minute he got on that boat, I was like, okay, pal, where are we going? What's happening? And the way you talk about the islands and the slates and the language that you use to describe the weather, all of it just made sense. And again, I haven't spent time on Lake Superior and, you know, we're not quite at the dystopian level of I right. cheerfully refuse.
Right.
But I felt really grounded in his story. And there's some great characters that we meet along the way who are wonderful and lovely. And there's some people where I'm like, dude, do not open that. Oh, you opened that door. Okay. And I mean, we read you for character. We read you for a sense of place. I mean, and the lake is its own country. It is absolutely its own country with its own rules.
And that's very much what you feel.
I mean,
we're not in dystopian times now, but Robin and I spent 15 summers being on the lake as much as we could. We at one point bought a big old boat and a heavy old thing that could stand up to the waves and the wind. And we spent 15 summers just exploring mostly the Apostle Islands, but sometimes beyond the Apostles. And the lake does feel like its own country when you're out there. You know, you get to some of the outer islands and you look around and you're the only boat you can see.
Yeah.
And the islands have this wildness. They're a protected lakeshore, so there's development on them. And you go past those kind of sawgrass dunes on the lake side of the islands, and it's like you really feel like there's just nobody out there. And if you get yourself in trouble, you got to get yourself out. That's why you buy a heavy boat. You've got to have something that will stand up to the incredible storms that can form in a big hurry on Lake Superior. But it feels very much like its own country, yeah.
But Rainey, too, he's so isolated in his world even before he sets out. Like, the boat is the thing that ultimately saves him. I'm not giving anything away by that because there are lots of different levels of that. But he's a little lost already.
Oh, I think he is. I mean, I think he's a character. Look, Rainey's history is that he grew up in a family of, kind of hardworking, non-reading people. Illiteracy is a problem in this future world.
Yo.
And he knows how to read, but he doesn't do it. You know, he says, you know, of his youth that he knew how to read. He was taught to read, but he just never did. It wasn't one of those practical things. And then when he meets Lark, he's in the library, not because he goes there to read, but because it's a warm place where he can go to eat a cheese sandwich, you know, hiding from study Carol, basically. And one day while he's there, he hears this voice, and it's the voice of a librarian at the information desk answering questions. And he cranes around, but he can't see her because she's out of his view, but he can hear that voice, and that voice, it's compelling to him. He is struck by her care when she is talking to people, when she is making recommendations, trying to help them find what they're looking for. And that voice just makes him feel at ease, and it makes him feel happy. And then he starts paying attention to what she's actually saying. And so she'll recommend a novel to someone, or he'll recommend this or that work of nonfiction. And he starts to think, well, if these works of written history or fiction are so important to her and to other people who are looking for them, maybe they'd be important to me. So he starts, he writes them all down. He's got a stub of pencil and he writes down whatever she says. And then he goes into the actual shelves in the library and finds the books and starts checking them out. And it changes his life. It opens his world. It kind of enlivens his capacity for love. And that makes him a larger person. But I think always, as far as we can tell, he's still that kid in some ways who hasn't quite found his way, who relies on Lark. I kind of love that sometimes things surprise you when you're writing them. And
yeah.
The surprise here was that he kind of fell in love with her before he ever saw her. He just heard her voice and he heard her kindness and he was so drawn to it. I sort of love that about him, that he had the capacity to fall for someone based on how she sounded.
Also sounds like a dude who worked in radio for a really long time.
Hey, radio is important to some of us.
It is. No, radio is very important. But I love the idea that that's where the connection comes, that the words are there first. I mean, obviously, you and I are book people, and when you're book people, you are slightly touched. I'm just going to say it. No, you know this to be true. Slightly touched.
Yes.
But the idea that kind of magic, right? You've talked about magic in the past and how it shows up when you really, really need it.
Absolutely.
And even though you're playing in terrain that is not all that familiar, but not all that unfamiliar.
Yeah.
There are these moments of magic. And sometimes it's picking the right song and being able to play the right song when you're facing a very, very bad guy. You pull in these moments where it's like, oh, right, that's who we are.
Right.
And it's not nostalgia. I mean,
I think more than nostalgia, I think it's an optimism.
Yeah.
I was talking to my son about optimism, and I was trying to make the point that anything that you pour effort into, that is a sign of optimism. Even if you're not out there like a Pollyanna playing the glad game or doing whatever, if you're working hard and you're interested, then you are inherently optimistic. And my son, Reed, who lives in New Jersey, said, I would qualify it in one way. I think it is effort in the service of love. I really like that. I thought that put a fine point on it, because we do have a lot of people working really hard for motives that aren't fantastic.
I think there's a line too between optimism and hope.
Yes, I think there is.
And hope sometimes can be harder. And hope is more of a discipline, I think, than optimism. Optimism, I love your son's definition. I think that is absolutely spot on. And yet Rainey, he's his own sort of messy human, and I love this. I didn't ever feel like Rainey was sort of ahead of this story, because, I mean, obviously it's you telling it, so we know we're in the right hands, but I never felt like he suddenly understood something that maybe he wouldn't have. He gets himself into some situations.
He makes a lot of mistakes, and you're right. He's a mess. And who wouldn't be? I mean, just writing a book like this is a messy operation. I sometimes felt like every morning I would get up and come to my office, and it felt like going down to a shoreline, and there's a boat shallows, and it's there's ropes everywhere, and the sail is a mess in the cockpit, and it was always every day a matter of climbing in and bailing out the water and coiling the ropes and doing whatever you're going to with the sail and getting it going. It was a messy process, but it was also the most fun I've ever had writing a book. Absolutely.
I think that shows. I think even when Rainey gets stuck in bits, there's something he discovers in the boat that has been left there by someone else.
Yeah.
And I can imagine the look on his face. Poor guy.
He didn't ask for that, except
no, he did not.
What he did, didn't he, with the border that arrives,
But it's so organic, the way everyone comes together and the way some people disappear, or the way some people leave and come back. This cast, it's not a huge cast, but everyone has sort of their turn. And it feels like there's a community.
The fun part about writing is that you get to write what you want in your life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I've always found it sort of difficult to make friends or have like a community that I was part of. That just is not super easy for me. But I dream about it. I dream about it all the time. Years ago, Robin and I we used to watch Notting Hill a lot.
Oh, that movie. Yes. I know which one you're talking about.
A terrific romantic comedy. Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts, How Do You Lose? But there's the best scenes in that are not the romantic scenes. The best scenes in that movie are sitting around the table with this group of friends and the kinds of conversations they have. And we used to watch that movie now and then. A couple times a year, we'd watch that and Robin. Mm-hmm. God, can we have that? And so the answer might be no. I mean, that's nothing we've managed to find all that often. Sometimes.
Yeah.
I would love for that to be a regular feature of everybody's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to write community. I like to write groups of friends. I like to write those gatherings. You know, Lark's birthday party in the backyard was enormous fun to write. And and so I made sure that I wrote little bits and scenes of community, even late in the game when things get just really dark as hell for Rainey. There's still ways that he can find community. And I love doing that.
How much of this book, though, comes out of some of the legwork for Virgil Wander? There might be folks who don't know that you actually ditched an entire first draft of Virgil Wander because you couldn't get the voice.
Yeah.
And the thing about I Cheerfully Refuse is I was immediately in because of the voice.
Oh, thank you.
And what you were doing with language, I'm still so excited about what you were doing with language. And I don't want to spoil it for listeners because, again, it is that sort of mix of Shakespearean, but not, it's not like Blade Runner either. It's, but you are doing something and creating this world where dialogue changes. And yet I know, like, for instance, Quixote, right? There's multiple references to Don Quixote, but the way they're deployed is so good and a little surprising. And have I ever finished Don Quixote? No, it's right there with Middlemarch. And one of those, I know I need to do it and I just have not done it yet. And someday I will. But they're the kinds of references that you can just get, I think, even if you haven't read.
Well, everybody knows what Quixote was.
Right? You
know, everybody understands that romantic, that madman who goes off with Sancho Panza and tilts at windmills. I mean, that's just part of the culture. Everybody knows it, whether or not they've ever read the book. And so that was really, really easy to work with and really fun to work with. And then if you have read through to the end, I mean, or refer to that, and the ending is such a disappointment to Rainey because Quixote is not really a madman in the final pages. And that's enormously disappointing. Who would read that book? if he weren't a madman, but no, he renounces it all at the end. What a disappointment he becomes in his sanity at the end, just before he dies. That really is a bummer for Rainey. I kind of get it. I kind of understand it. But Rainey can't bear it. He's a little bit of an idealist about his Quixote.
He is. He's also a little bit of an idealist about a lot of things.
Oh,
but
yeah.
In a way where he very kind of quietly sticks his ground without realizing he's quietly sticking his ground.
I think you're right.
But Quixote is part of this mythology, right? Like, we know when we're reading one of your novels that there is going to be this sort of worldview. Call it mythology, however you want to describe it. I'm going to stick to mythology because that works for me. And mythology is a word that I just, like, for instance, family mythology. I'm like, yes, we've all heard the stories of our own families where you're like, okay. I do not believe one word of that, but cool. You keep telling that story every Sunday night. That's great. Keep doing it.
I love that. And we need that.
We do. We absolutely do. And we can, you know, take the bits that are useful and leave the bits that are behind. But the mythology of Rainey's world, and there is a very bad dude that readers will meet. And one of the things I love about it, though, is he's threatening because he's so quiet and everyone's just a little scared of him. He's not running around crashing furniture or, you know, whipping out pistols or anything like that. He's just one of those dudes who's really scary because he's just who he is.
Yeah, and I think that there are people like that, and mm-hmm. And yet he's also I think a product of the mythology that's always running around up here. I like the word mythology as well. Where would we be without it? You know, right? Those are the stories that stick, and that's why they're myths. And every time I think probably most writers are this way, but every time I sit down to start a project, and the first sort of blocks of story start being visible, you know, when you're breaking the yard or whatever, and there's mm-hmm. like it's a stone, and you always hope that the thing you uncover is going to be Stonehenge. You always hope that it's going to be that something that is really well constructed and will stand for a long time. You really mm-hmm. hope. And one way to sort of urge yourself in that direction is to immerse yourself in stories that are like that, old stories, newer stories that kind of have the venerable feel, the feel of architecture. I always try to stay around stories like that.
You know, in the past, you've talked about Ann Tyler and Nick Hornby and Michael Chabon. I was just thinking of Cavalier and Clay, actually, as you were talking. It's an early Chabon, but again, the world building in that book, right, is, I mean, every brick is in place.
So many his books, even going all the way back to The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, you know.
Yeah.
There too, it's another world. Pittsburgh yeah. is another world, and there's the cloud factory, you know, that too. I mean, I remember reading that mm-hmm. and in my 20s and just thinking, oh no. How can anybody be this good, this young? It should have discouraged me, but it didn't really. I mean, it just made me outrageously happy, like most of his novels.
And one of the things I love about that thread too with all of those writers is exactly that. Yeah. They write with a lot of joy, and you do as well. Even when stuff goes off the rails, let's put it that way, there's still a lot of joy inherent in the story. You have a lot of faith in your characters.
Oh, I do. And I never write a character I don't really love.
Right.
I mean, I don't admire all of them, but I love them all. I really do. And otherwise, I don't know how you write somebody fairly, you know, or with authenticity. If they're only there to be, you know, like a tool in the plot, or to further momentum, or whatever that might be. You mentioned joy, and honestly, I think I'm only doing this because I get so much joy out of it. That's really the only because you know every paragraph, and I love talking in terms of paragraphs because that's mm-hmm. such a beautiful little handful of sentences. A paragraph has to move your story along. It has to serve a dramatic purpose. It needs elements of story and character and you know, momentum.
Right.
And it also has to create some weather. It has to create, I think, for the reader, some kind of an atmosphere, because during a long book, you're going to want people to feel joyful. You're going to want them to feel heartbroken. You're going to need them to sometimes have the sensation of what it's like to sense that morning is going to come after a long, terrible night. You know, that kind of rinsed feeling that you get. You're going to need them to feel a lot of things.
Right.
And that's where the real fun part comes in, because my books tend to land after a long absence, you know, and that's why it takes me so long. Because I want the weather to be right in all these paragraphs.
Well, weather and voice, right? Like, weather and voice to me are not things you can separate.
Probably not.
I mean, and I'm not just talking about whether or not you write the book in the first person or a close third or whatever. It's yeah. just the voice of the narrative. And, yeah. you know, like I said earlier, you threw out the first draft of Virgil Wander because you're like, oh, it didn't get the voice.
No, the voice was all wrong.
So when did Rainey show up? I mean, I cheerfully refuse. Are we really starting with Lake Superior, or are we starting with Rainey and Lake Superior?
Rainey came first.
Okay.
Rainey came first. I knew it would be on Lake Superior because by then we lived here, and I had this thing in my head. Many years ago, the first time I sailed on Lake Superior, I was with my brother-in-law and a friend of his, and they invited me to go sailing with them on the friend's boat. And at that point, I thought, oh, this is a place I have to write about. This is a city that I need to make use of at some point. All kinds of crazy things happened in that 7 days. And the first scene that came to my head with this book was Rainey in the library, hearing the voice of a librarian that he couldn't see, but who was deeply attractive to him. And so I wrote that scene and honestly didn't change really a word of it. I mean, from the first draft to the last, because that was where the book started for me. That love story. And so once I had that, then the rest of it made itself kind of plain.
I do love Lark as a character. We're not ignoring her. She is remarkable in a million different kinds of ways. She's also a bookseller, so, you know, there's always going to be an affinity there.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea that their relationship is grounded in words first.
Yeah, that tells you something about how far Rainey had to come.
Yeah.
And also about how willing Lark was to see him as something more than his origins.
Mm-hmm.
I love that about her. Book people, in my experience, tend to be people whose worldviews can stretch,
yeah,
and can accommodate a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different ideas. And it was really fun to write about this person who starts out as a librarian, and then when they move out of Duluth and they move up the shore to Icebridge, mm-hmm, she becomes a bookseller almost by accident.
I've heard that story before.
Yes, I know. That's how most people become booksellers, I think. It's almost by accident. I love the idea that books themselves are a kind of contraband.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely illegal, but right, kind of frowned on. When the book begins, we find out that the country has just elected its first sort of proudly illiterate president. A guy who really sees that this is in his favor. He's never been spoiled by words and ideas. Doesn't strike me as all that unlikely. Even though I wrote it as a kind of joke, it turned out to be something that doesn't seem impossible.
Isn't that part of the power of story, though? Because, I mean, ultimately, how many... Guy leaves on a trip. Guy walks in a bar. Guy meets a stranger on the road. I mean, when you strip it down to the mythology, right? If you strip story down to its very basic elements, guy falls in love.
Yeah.
Guy's life changes. And obviously, since we're talking about Rainey, that's why I'm using guy. But obviously, it can be anyone. And I love the idea that there are sort of storytelling, there are universalities of story, right? Where it doesn't matter whether I'm from Boston and you're from the tiny town that you're from. That's what, right? 1,700 people?
Yeah.
Is it still that little?
I think it's 1,200 and some.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's really small. It was a good place to grow up.
Yeah. Okay. And you've got the run of the land. And yeah. I mean, my brother and I sort of had the run of woods behind the house kind of thing. And, you know, mom would ring a bell when it was time to come home. But to have access to that sort of natural world and to be that connected to the natural world and being paying attention to where the clouds are. Just watching Rainey figure out how he fits into a world that has no rules,
yeah,
right? There is no sort of social contract anymore.
No, there's not.
It's wild watching him figure out. I mean, money doesn't exist, but he can still make music.
Yeah, and actually, he was taught by a man to play bass, who said, first do no harm.
Right.
As a bass player, your job is to first do no harm. When I started playing the electric bass, that was what my brother-in-law taught me. With one rule, first do no harm. And what he meant was, you don't hijack the song.
Mm-hmm.
You don't mess up the groove. Your job is to lock in to the drummer and not try to take the spotlight. You support the song. You're a bass player. That's what you do. I loved that. I loved that about the electric bass. And I loved how it also, once you began to understand it,
mm-hmm,
like Rainey does, he understands not only his job as kind of a foundational part of the song, but one that really can't be heard by most people. You don't really hear the bass in most songs. You just sort of feel it. It kind of hits you here rather than here, but it's absolutely necessary. Rainey starts to understand that and to understand how that fits into other parts of his world as well. That there are people who are comforted by deep tones. Early in the story, there's a character named Labrino, and Labrino sometimes just shows up at Rainey and Lark's house,
yeah,
in order to be comforted by Rainey playing the bass because he needs it. It helps him. It centers him. There are mythologies in which the world is created countless eons ago by deep bass tones. And it's like they used to say, the music of the spheres. And Rainey, he hasn't run into all those ideas, but he senses it. He understands that at some level that is true. And so that's his form of creativity and one of his forms of joy.
We can still be joyful at the end of the world, right? I'm going to choose to believe that.
I think we have a duty to be joyful.
I also have books. I have books and story and writers and characters that surprise me and delight me and maybe poke me a little bit in the shoulder and say, well, what do you actually think? And, you know, as a bookseller, there is a slight tendency to talk about fictional characters like they're real people. And to other book people, it makes perfect sense. And then to strangers, they're kind of like, are you okay?
Yeah.
Do you miss this world?
Oh, well, no, because I'm in it.
Okay.
I mean, we live, like I said, 6 blocks off the water.
Okay.
It's not close enough to see the lake from the living room windows. But if I go up to the 3rd floor in the wintertime when the leaves are off the trees, and I go up to Robin's quilting studio and look out the window, I can see Lake Superior. When I go outside, every time I hit a cross street, I look down the hill and there's the water. I feel very much like I'm in that world all the time. And, you know, it's better than Rainey's in that everything hasn't fallen apart. And I don't want that to happen. But on the other hand, this still has the beauty of that world in the book. That's a beautiful world. His crazy, kind of off-center, screwed up world is gorgeous. And I loved being in it. I mean, I wasn't in a hurry to finish because I just loved being in it. It was enjoyable to write about. And the water is, man, it's just life itself, you know. The lake is like a local deity.
No, I mean, isn't that what art is for, though? I mean, aren't we supposed to be asking these questions and saying, what if, and where do we go, and how do we do this? And like, how do we imagine the thing that feels unimaginable?
Yeah.
Right? Again, this goes back to mythology. Kid dies. Parents die.
Yeah.
You know, how do we process what our experience of the world is, and what does it mean to move forward when we don't actually know what that looks like?
Oh, yeah, terrifying, right? But that's kind of that's the fun of this job is that you get to go out and everything looks dark. Maybe optimism only means something when you first go out and admit to yourself, oh, everything is dark and painful as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe only then can you reach into your pocket and light a match. You know, the matches are in there, but if you don't admit it's dark outside, you're never going to reach in your pocket. And for me, what writing a book like this was for, at a time when, you know, when things seemed to be going in so many unfriendly directions at once, mm-hmm. it was just a way of lighting a match and going forward through the dark to see where the path led, and then maybe lighting another one from that one when it burned. I found it to be a very joyful and pleasurable experience.
Mm-hmm.
I completely enjoyed writing this.
Aren't you kind of a legendary outliner too, though? Don't you have a little bit of a roadmap?
Well, no. I mean, I do. I have an outline, but basically, it's I know where I think the story is going to end.
Okay.
I know where I'm going to put in kind of a, you know, you get 80 or 90 pages in,
mm-hmm.
kind of need a spin. You got to spin things in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise it will start to seem tedious and you set yourself up for that famous baggy middle that doesn't seem to go anywhere. So what I usually have in mind is an ending, which may or may not be the one in this case, it wasn't the one that I wrote.
Oh.
But I had an ending in mind.
Okay.
And then I had a spin in mind for about a third of the way through. And I had that glorious romance at the beginning with Rainey and Lark. And that's what I had when I started. And I started Miwa on the day we went into lockdown in Minnesota.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I'd been making notes for, you know, I don't know, a year and a half.
Yeah.
And then the day we went into lockdown, Robin just said, well, this is your chance. Go for it. You know, actually start the book. And I thought, man, she's 100% right. So I started and I wrote the first draft in about 3 months, which for me is terribly fast.
Right. Right.
But then, of course, I did rewrite it for 2.5 years after that.
Yeah, but I think you've always been one of those writers where the writing is actually the rewriting. And especially having now read it twice, I feel like there's no way this could have been written quickly. There's too much detail. that's true to the world and the characters. There's too much language that you have clearly created, and it works so well that that's not, hey, I'm going to go get a quart of milk and a bag of oranges and come back and the rest of my grocery list is the outline for an entirely new world.
And you said it exactly, Miwa. The rewriting is the writing, and the rewriting is where the real work happens. You see that your vibe is wrong in a particular paragraph, and you switch out some words and you take out some stuff. Usually it's taking out. Mm-hmm. I tend to overwrite and then take out. You ramp up or ramp down the sort of emotion that you want to have flowing underneath the text. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, I mean, I know that there are other writers who manage to do all that and do it swiftly. Mm-hmm. For me, it just takes a long time. I've had to learn to accept that.
You know, Calvin Trillin has this old, very, very old, it may not even be in print anymore, called Deadline Poet. And it's kind of a memoir of his work in journalism. And did you ever formally study poetry? I don't think you did, right?
No,
you really did come out of it. Okay. And this is the thing, and I keep coming back to your, you know, almost 20 years at Minnesota Public Radio, because when you're talking to that many people, you get a sense of language and a rhythm of language that's really hard to replicate. And you know this too. You read enough where you know when you're reading dialogue that just doesn't quite swing and you're like,
oh yeah,
I see what you're trying to do and it's not working. And here though, you found a way to replicate patterns of speech without all of our likes and and, you know, all of the stuff that makes us truly human.
Right.
But there's a rhythm there that I really do think comes out of interviewing people. And I'm not saying that just because I do this on the side of being a bookseller, but when you're around people listening that much, it's hard to let go of patterns of speech.
Well, and especially, Miwa, if you're like, I was in radio all that time.
Yeah.
When I write dialogue that works, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It comes directly out of that experience of interviewing people. And the other great thing about being a journalist first is that you never quite lose then that journalistic privilege that you have to just go up to somebody that you're watching and ask them a question. Or I was a journalist, I never would have even thought you could do that. Hey, tell me how this works. What are you doing? How long have you been doing this thing? Do you like it? Does this fulfill you? And then you're a journalist and that's your job. And it's like, I can find out anything I want. Mm-hmm. Well, I quit journalism a long time ago, but I never stopped doing that. You can just go up to people and have a conversation. It's brilliant. And people enjoy it. And mm-hmm. I enjoy it. Good things come out of it. Good dialogue comes from it.
And having read I Cheerfully Refuse, oh, the dialogue just snaps. It is so good. It is so good. Even there's a young girl who shows up and she is an actual young girl and not a 40-year-old disguised as a tiny person. You know this has happened. I'm telling you, you know this has happened. You've read those novels too. And everyone just has their moment. And this world is, oh, it's delightful. But it is. It's details and dialogue and a little bit of pacing, but it's character and place and all of the things that you get lost in.
That makes me want to ask you a question, Miwa,
okay.
Because you probably read more than anybody I know.
you read a lot.
And I listen to a lot of your interviews, mm-hmm. and you are not reading in a surface way. You're not skimming.
No.
You're really paying attention to these books. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, what is it about a book that gets your attention and actually sweeps you away? Because when I'm reading, I finish a third of the books that I start, if I'm lucky,
right.
because they don't sweep me up. And I just, mm-hmm. I'm too old to waste time with books I'm not going to like. But what is it that does that for you?
So for me, and I'm going to preface this with, I wish we could start a movement where all of the people who feel like they have to finish a book that they've started that they don't like can just walk away. There's a book for everyone. Pass it on to someone else. If it is not swinging for you, just do not waste your time because there is always going to be something coming along. So we're going to start that movement, you and I, and we're going to go from there. For me, it's kind of, I know it when I see it. And I think that translates to voice. And if there's a voice that I am willing to trust, i.e. follow wherever it takes me, there are times where I've had manuscripts dropped in front of me and I understand what the writer is trying to do. But if I see the seams, I get a little itchy.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of times where I finish things that I might not be in love with, because I did mention bookseller, hi, job. But the things that I really, really love and the things that sort of stick with me over time, and I've been doing this for more than a minute. So actually my sort of the context that I have for the business and the kinds of books that I read, I mean, there's some old Barry Hannah and Tom McGuane rattling around in the back of my brain, you know? All right. I knew this would happen. I knew we would run long. I knew we could go longer. Actually, we could probably do this a lot longer. But you have another book to write at some point. I have a couple more interviews to do. And we're just going to have a grand old time letting people listen to this show. This was so much fun. Leifanger, thank you so much. I Cheerfully Refuse is out. If somehow you have not read Virgil Wander or So Young, Brave, and Handsome or Peace Like a River, please tell me you've read Peace Like a River. By all means, we have those as well. So Leif, thank you so much.
Miwa, what a pleasure. Thanks for having me. I look forward to talking with you more.
Hello, readers. It's time for another TBR Top Off. We're going to recommend a couple of fantastic books to pick up when you stop in for your copy of I Cheerfully Refuse. I'm Mark. I'm at my Barnes & Noble in Cincinnati, and I'm joined by my book buddy, Mary, in Beaumont, Texas. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mark.
I'm going to go ahead and kick things off. First off, I have to say, anything new by Leifanger is always a joy. So I'm really excited for people to read this book. I just started an advanced copy and I'm having a lot of fun with it. So can't wait for people to chew this book up. It's great. But I was thinking about heart-filled adventure stories, things that have a level of excitement, but are coupled with beautiful feels. And I thought of a book I read not too long ago called All Our Shimmering Skies by Trent Dalton. This is a pretty wild ride through 1940s Australia that just made me smile throughout the whole book. It follows a girl named Molly who has just escaped the Japanese bombing of her town that annihilated everything she knew, including her family. She is left alone and angry and very determined to exact revenge or kind of just find her place now. There's a lot going on in this young girl's head. So she basically sets off on a voyage of fairly epic proportions, but it's not really what you would find in a normal World War II historical fiction novel. The setting itself is already very different from what a lot of folks are used to reading, but the storytelling and the voice and the narrative is so refreshing. Molly's adventure is such a good departure. She's joined by two very, very unlikely companions, both of whom I think could have their own book and you would just want to follow them wherever they go. And their adventure goes across Australia's Northern Territory. They are searching for truth and treasure and a little bit of vengeance and just a new place. So think almost Wizard of Oz meets a Dickens, Whitman, Marquez mashup. There's a lot of elements going on that shouldn't all work together, but do. And it just makes for a really enjoyable ride. It is strange and silly and warm and kind and magical and a little bit healing. Please check out All Our Shimmering Skies by Trent Dalton. Mary, what do you have for us?
So when I first got my hands on I Cheerfully Refuse, the first book I thought of was The Summer Guest by Justin Cronin. Yes, that Justin Cronin. The Summer Guest is about a journey, but it's someone's last journey. We meet Harry Rainwright, who's dying, and he wants to go fishing in his favorite fishing camp in Maine one more time. All of our characters have secrets. Lucy and Joe, who run the fishing camp, their daughter Kate, Jordan, who's Harry's fishing guide, and we flash back and forth between past and present at the camp and now at the camp. It's one of those books that feels way shorter than it is. It moves at such a great pace, and the story moves along until all the secrets are revealed in the magical forgotten place that is Maine at a fishing camp. So my pick for TBR Top Off is The Summer Guest by Justin Cronin.
Fantastic. He's usually known for like large scale, mm-hmm. horrific yes. things, but he's in this, he's really not afraid to like poke at your heartstrings and tug a little bit while still being like unsettling and eerie in a great way. So,
oh, yeah.
Of course, as you would expect. Nice choice. But that is all we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to Poured Over. Please make sure to give us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on our socials at Barnes & Noble. I'm Mark. You can follow my home store at BN Westchester. Mary, where can we find you?
I'm Mary. You can follow me at BN Beaumont TX.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Happy reading. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.